Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Late last decade, my co-host Jim Caruso and I were America's Chief of Mission and Senior Defense Official to Australia, respectively, while our guest today was the Prime Minister of that country. But it was Jim's explicit job to represent the President of the United States to our guest, so I'm going to let Jim introduce him. Jim?
Well, it's Malcolm Turnbull, lawyer, entrepreneur, politician, and eventually becoming Prime Minister of Australia. We're very honored to have Malcolm Turnbull with us today. Malcolm, welcome to the Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Our first question, why should the Indo-Pacific care whether we elect Harris or Trump over here?
Well, the American elections are the most consequential democratic elections in the world. You know, we all have a stake in the outcome of US elections, but only the Americans have a say in them. So, you know, the whole world is watching. So any US presidential election is of the keenest interest in this part of the world, as it is right around the world. But on this occasion, you have in President Trump a very, very different president. He poses very high risks. There's no question about that. And you know, that's in a sense like saying the Pope's a Catholic. I mean, he sets out to create risks. He is deliberately erratic. He seeks to unsettle and rattle close allies and alliances. He seeks to create uncertainty and unpredictability, and he brags about his ability so to do. He sucks up to, or flatters, or befriends, use your verb of choice, dictators and tyrants. He boasted at the Republican National Convention of his great affection for Kim Jong-un, for example, someone he befriended when he was president and, according to him, exchanged love letters, bizarrely enough. This is a very different type of president. So with Harris, we don't know a lot about Harris's views on foreign policy. Quite honest, she hasn't really said a lot in her either previous to being vice president or as vice president. We do know her closest foreign policy national security advisor, Phil Gordon, however, who is a very experienced and distinguished diplomat, most recent book is an outstanding analysis of American failure in foreign policy terms in the Middle East over 70 years. If she is taking advice from people like him, you could imagine a high degree of continuity and a more consistent, thoughtful approach to foreign policy in the region. But Trump poses high risks, no doubt about that.
Mr. Turnbull, in May, you penned an article for Foreign Affairs magazine, and you talked about your experience as a head of government dealing with Donald Trump. And you said that in your experience with Trump, that meant that ambassadors and foreign ministers, no matter how capable, could offer much less assistance and influence, and that the key relationship lay between Trump and the foreign leader. Two questions. First, why? What is it that the foreign leader needs to do directly with Donald Trump? And did Jim's job really not matter that much?
Well, Jim, of course, offered not just himself as the representative of the United States government, but his incredible charm, wit, and wisdom was really the most valuable thing he brought to the office of chargé in the American embassy in Canberra. Look, the reality is Trump, back in 2016 when Trump was elected, there was a lot of speculation about how to deal with Trump. And, you know, most people pretty much everyone got it wrong as it happened, but how to deal with him. But the one thing we do know from experience is that he, you know, he doesn't read briefs. He's skeptical about advice. He pays more attention to what he sees on the latest show on Fox News than he does on any briefing from, you know, the intelligence community, let alone the State Department. Even people in the White House have limited influence. So, you know, the traditional way of dealing with a government, you know, of working through officials and advisors and, you know, the bureaucracy, however you want to call it, doesn't really work with Trump. It's more important than ever to have a direct relationship with him as president than, you know, than with a more conventional president. I mean, you guys served in that administration. I mean, do you disagree with that? That was certainly my experience. And I gave a few examples in that essay in Foreign Affairs to demonstrate it.
He is certainly different in every possible way that we can think of. But what's interesting to us is after a rocky start, which you mentioned in the article, you managed to forge a sort of working relationship with Trump. Part of it was your own charm and the ability to figure him out. As you said, you've dealt with that sort of media mogul before and know some of their buttons. But I think it's also because Australia pays a fair amount into its defense. The United States has a big trade surplus with Australia. So there's nothing for him to hang his usual hat on for being aggrieved. But if you're advising someone like in Japan or Vietnam, which doesn't have these attributes, how would you tell those foreign leaders to deal with Trump?
Well, the fundamental point is, Trump is a big narcissistic bully, right? He has a type of personality, you know, overwhelmingly self-centered. If he wins office again, his deep conviction that he is a genius and can walk on water will only have been confirmed, right? So, you know, he'll be like the Roman emperor entering the imperial capital in his chariot, but he won't have the slave standing next to him saying, "Remember, you are immortal." So he will be surrounded by yes men, but there won't be the same number of sensible, patriotic people, you know, like Jim Mattis, who serve in order, not because they're particularly fond of Trump or by his rhetoric, but because they feel it's important to have good people in the administration. It'll be a much more ideological administration. And you see that with his choice of vice president, with J.D. Vance. I mean, J.D. Vance is very different to Mike Pence. I mean, you know, Mike Pence was a fairly conventional conservative Republican. You know, he'd been a governor, people like, you know, whether you liked his politics or not, he was definitely had both feet grounded in reality. J.D. Vance is a much more ideological character and has got quite radical views on foreign policy. Views quite inconsistent with traditional Republican views. So I think the worst, you've got to say, the worst aspects of Trump 1 are likely to be magnified in Trump 2 based on, I mean, because you see the mistakes of Trump 1 in Trump's eyes are being listening to and being constrained by the Washington official establishment, you know, the swamp. Sort of, I mean, and you know, you guys are you know, with great respect to you, from Trump's point of view, you are sort of swamp creatures. You know, you're part of the State Department, you know, part of those, you know, what I would say, dedicated civil servants, patriotically serving your country and doing often dangerous work for remuneration that is vastly below what you could command in the private sector, but you're doing it out of patriotism. But in the MAGA landscape, you are terrible swamp creatures, you know, standing, preventing the will of the people from being executed by their elected leaders.
It's the webbed feet, actually. But we do try to be balanced and objective here. So I want to, as a contrast to what you've just described, I want to offer this quote from a Foreign Affairs article that says, "The caricature of Trump as a one-dimensional, irrational monster is so entrenched that many forget that he can be, when it suits him, intelligently transactional."
And that that's why I wrote that. Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. And equally, exactly. I mean, I think that's very important. And I developed a good transactional relationship with him. But, you know, this is not to say that his return does not, you know, does not pose great risks. And equally, just because Trump is in favor of something doesn't mean it's wrong. You know, you get a, you know, they talk about Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, that's fair enough. But I mean, look, you know, two things can be right at the same time. You know, he can be, you can have a guy who is erratic, ill-disciplined, and, you know, posing, you know, I would say high risks on the one hand. On the other hand, you can have someone who can be intelligently transactional when he sees things as being in his own interest. I mean, do you want me to describe the example about the steel tariffs? I mean, it's a good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, this is a good example. So you may remember fairly early in Trump's term, he announced he was going to impose a universe, you know, on everybody, 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminium. Now, you know, there were plenty of people in the administration who argued against that, including his son-in-law, including Gary Cohen, you know, including the Treasury Secretary. But, you know, Trump's always been keen on tariffs, right? He's a protectionist. I mean, the things that he has been focused on for most of his public life going back decades, what we would call isolationism and protectionism, right? And it's all very well to say he doesn't understand the economics of trade, and it may be that he doesn't, but if that's the case, he hasn't understood them for like 30 odd years or 40 years. So you're not going to change his mind on that. So he wanted to impose those steel tariffs, and I was determined that they not be imposed on Australia. And there is a tendency on the part of Australian leaders and Australian representatives who generally have an excessively deferential and sycophantic attitude to the United States, which I do not think helps us in Washington. You guys might be too tactful to respond to that, but that's my considered and observed opinion. There is a tendency to say, oh, well, you know, we've been your ally in countless wars and, you know, you've got to help us out, right? And 100 years of mateship and so forth. But the reality is the United States has a lot of allies, you know. And, I mean, it double-crossed its oldest ally, France, in the over the, you know, AUKUS, you know, submarine thing. So there's no, you know, I think you've got to assume great nations act in their own interest. That's the safest bet in my experience. And so what I set out to do was to persuade Trump that imposing that tariff on Australian steel was actually contrary to American interests. And And the reason for that was we had very relatively small amount of steel was being exported. It was going to the West Coast, but it was being exported essentially by one company, BlueScope. It was being used for building materials. The reason it was being, I mean, we are not a low-cost producer, obviously, but it was being exported because the cost of shipping steel from the Midwest or the East Coast to California is actually higher than it is of shipping it by boat from, you know, ship from New South Wales. So, in fact, if their tariff had been imposed, all it would have done was reduced demand for that type of roofing steel in California and replace it with other non-steel materials. And it certainly wouldn't have resulted in more American steel being used for that purpose. So anyway, I explained that to him. To his credit, he listened to it. He understood it. You know, he's a property developer. He actually knew the product I was talking about. We did this over a number of meetings, including a rather hilarious one in a skiff in Hamburg, involving Emmanuel, a rather bemused and confused, I would say, Emmanuel Macron, who had no idea what was going, what we were talking about. But I talked him around, and I was also able to say, pivoting back to what Jim said, I said, look, if your argument is that America wants, under your leadership, wants fair trade, how can you impose a tariff on us when you have you already have a free trade agreement? You have no tariffs, no quotas, complete open access to our market, and you have a very large surplus. I mean, it literally cannot, America cannot improve its terms of trade with Australia. It's impossible. Like, it's as good as you'll ever get anywhere. So, and to be fair, he listened. Now, he had Lighthizer and Wilbur Ross. I can't recall Navarro. I'm sure he was of the same mind, but certainly Lighthizer and Wilbur Ross were absolutely against what I was putting to him. But, you know, we sorted it out, and it was done in a series of, mostly one-on-one meetings and one-on-one phone calls. Now, you know, that was I think that was only made possible because I'd won his respect by having, you know, a rather explosive row with him early in his presidency. I'm not sure how that was received, how that was seen at from the State Department perspective, Jim, at the time, but it was fairly challenging.
You may recall that after that phone call, what? Justin, your national security advisor, called me and then put you on the phone.
Yeah.
And you weren't as calm as you are now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was pretty wild. But it was the right thing. But you see, it was absolutely the right thing to do because my point is that with bullies, and Trump is a bully, if you don't stand up to them, you get more bullying. I mean, I'll illustrate this with some of your Australian listeners may remember who I'm talking about, but there's a very famous television executive here who was a great friend of mine called Sam Chisholm, sadly no longer with us, ran the Nine Network. He ran B Sky B for Rupert in the UK. And, you know, he was a very big, big, big personality. And I had a run-in with him very early in my career would have been in the early 80s, I guess. He said, I'm a bully. My approach in life is to bully everyone I can bully. And on the rare occasions I meet people I can't bully, then I treat them with respect. And he said this as he was offering me a glass of champagne. Now, that was a guy who was being very honest, but that's how bullies operate. So, you know, if you give in to them, you set yourself up for more of the same.
So if you are an ally of the U.S. dealing with the transactional president and the terms are too dear, what do you do? Do you work with the other allies?
Well, I think it depends on the situation, and you know, you've got to be intelligent about this. But the you do need to be able to stand your ground, and of course, you know, one of the advantages with the United States, obviously, it is, you know, a bit creaky at the moment, to say the least. But it is a democracy. There are plenty of other angles you can approach, whether it's media or Congress, to, you know, make your case. But the important thing, I think, is to the important thing is always to stand up for yourself. And I mean, the sort of backslapping, sycophantic approach, which a number of leaders tried to take with Trump, was actually a mistake. And I mean, a good example of that is Boris Johnson. You know, I mean, there are others, but I mean, Boris, you remember, campaigned for Brexit on the basis that Britain was going to get a fabulous free trade deal with the United States. You know, don't worry, we're going to leave, we're going to walk out of the largest free trade zone in the world. I mean, just saying that makes you realize what an act of stupidity it was. But anyway, we're going to walk out of that. But don't worry, we're going to get a fabulous free trade deal of our own with the US. Well, you know, all of the bonhomie and charm and whatever is not going to achieve that because, you know, as I said, you know, great nations, great nations, small nations, will always act in their own self-interest. But the difficulty is the great nations have fewer constraints on their ability to do so.
Mr. Turnbull, you brought up the AUKUS deals, and I thought we'd give you a chance to talk about that, since obviously your take on that's a little different than what is the sort of the received wisdom these days in Washington, London, and Canberra. But what are your objections to the AUKUS deal? Do you object to the nuclear-powered submarines themselves? Do you object to the abrogation of the deal with France? How would you characterize your objections?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, obviously, the way France was treated was really bad. And I mean, not many people would disagree with that, I don't think. I mean, President Biden, you know, effectively apologized to Macron publicly over it. So it caused a rupture between the United States and its oldest ally. It was extraordinary. But let's not labour that. That's water long under the bridge. I think the idea of enhanced cooperation between Australia, the UK and the US is a very good thing. So AUKUS Pillar 2, which is the, part of AUKUS, which is meant to focus on technology, defence, you know, related technology, is a good thing if it is made to work. I mean, one of the difficulties is that the United States defence establishment is very geared to support the American defence industry. You know, there's a reason why Eisenhower called it the, you know, military industrial complex, right? And it is. And there's, and I respect that. I respect that. But it is challenging for, say, Australian defence industry, such as it is, to be given effective access to the US market. I mean, the goal of AUKUS Pillar 2 should be that Australia, the US and the UK are treated effectively as one country in terms of defence industry and technology exchange. Now, as you guys know, we effectively are in signals intelligence already, you know. I mean, the degree of cooperation between, our signals directorate, you know, yours and the UK's is very, very intimate. I mean, it'd be hard to get much more so. So I think AUKUS Pillar 2, the vision is good, that the challenge is going to be making it work. In terms of the submarines, that is where I think there has been a terrible mistake a really terrible mistake. We had with France a partnership to build in Australia diesel electric submarines based on the design of France's latest nuclear boat, the Suffren class, or short fin Barracuda, literally the newest submarine in the water today. And there was obviously a path to go move to naval nuclear propulsion with that design, because it was, after all, originally a nuclear boat. The reason we didn't opt, we being my government, and you know, frankly, any government prior to mine, hadn't opted for naval nuclear propulsion, was that we don't have a nuclear industry in Australia. So we wouldn't have been able, in the time frame involved, to develop the ability to support naval nuclear propulsion in a sovereign way. And obviously it's important if you're going to be spending a lot of money on military capabilities that they are genuinely sovereign. Now, the way AUKUS, so Morrison, you know, blew that up. He lied to Macron, which is terrible, you know, and I mean, done. To me, I've got to say, as a former prime minister, I could not have in any circumstance have behaved in the way he did, right? It's literally beyond my ken that a Australian PM would do what he did. But there it is. This is why character matters. We're in a situation now where the long-term plan is for Australia and the UK to develop a nuclear-powered submarine together, called the AUKUS SSN, which is not yet completely designed and would not be available, you know, if all went well, which as we all know it won't, you know, because these things get delayed, sometime in the 2040s. Now, in the meantime, our existing fleet of diesel electric submarines, the Collins class, are aging, getting very old, you know, between 20 and 30 years old. So what's going to fill the gap in the 2030s? And so the solution that was cooked up was that the US would sell Australia 2 and potentially 5 Virginia-class submarines, which are the US Navy's SSNs, or, you know, newest SSNs. And they are, you know, outstanding submarines. They are certainly the, you know, the best strategic asset of the US Navy, you know, leaving aside the nuclear deterrent, the big, you know, SSBNs, the boomers. And, you know, that on the face of it, that sounds sensible. The problem is that your Navy, the US Navy, is at least 17 Virginias short of what it needs. Your industry is producing about 1.2 to 1.3 Virginias a year. It needs to be producing twice as many, more than twice as many. And the legislation that the Congress has passed to authorize the sale of their Virginias expressly states that they cannot be sold, no boats can be sold to Australia, unless 270 days prior to the proposed sale, the President certifies to the Congress, and the Congress doesn't, you know, object, certifies to the Congress that the Navy does not need them. I think the specific language is it will not detract from the underwater capabilities of the Navy. So, you know, you're in a situation where that you think about it, you know, the Navy's short of this class of submarine already. The industry is not producing enough, although there are efforts to crank up the production rate. So the risk that the US Navy and or US President says, hang on, we love you dearly, Australians, but we need these boats ourselves because they are our most important strategic and most survivable assets in the Pacific Fleet. We can't spare them. That risk is borne entirely by Australia. Now, that to me is an incredible abdication of sovereignty. So it's, See, at least with the French project, we were building the boats ourselves. Now, if they were late or they cost too much or whatever, you know, or something went wrong, that would have been all our fault. You know, we'd acquired the technology from France, but we were in control. Now, with this, we have no agency and no leverage. And in fact, another part of this is we're providing a submarine base for nuclear submarines in Perth, which we're building, out of which a number of US Virginias will rotate and an occasional British submarine will visit. And there is an option canvassed in the Congressional Research Service's very, you know, comprehensive analysis of this, which I'd commend everyone to if you're interested, to basically that the scenario they're canvassing is one where Australia has no submarines at all. And this is called a sort of military partnership, and which is the euphemism. But what that basically means is the US would provide the submarines, we'd provide the submarine base, and the money we would otherwise spend on the submarines, we would spend on something else, you know, bombers, drones, you know, surface vessels, something else. So my criticism, which is limited to AUKUS Pillar 1, is that effectively it has been an abandonment of Australian sovereignty. And I think we've abandoned sovereignty in the search for security, and we'll end up diminishing both. So that's my argument against it.
So you're not opposed to a nuclear submarine option as being preferable to a diesel electric. It's the method of how to acquire them that's your issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Jim, I'm not a submariner, right? So I'm an enthusiastic amateur on this topic, as I am in most things I talk about. There are submariners who would say that, yes, naval nuclear propulsion gives you greater speed and greater endurance, no question about that. On the other hand, if you're talking about the archipelagic waters to our north, you know, around Indonesia, Straits of Malacca, etc., a modern diesel-electric submarine with air independent propulsion, you know, which can stay submerged and run on batteries for weeks on end, they are actually much quieter boats. And there are some submariners that would say that if you want a submarine that can go at high speed off, you know, to the South China Sea and patrol off Taiwan or support the US Navy in the East China Sea, yep, absolutely, naval nuclear propulsion is the way to go. But if you want to be able to operate with a more covertly in the shallower archipelagic waters to our north, the modern air independent propulsion types would be more suitable. Now, you know, I don't know whether that I couldn't give. You'd have to talk to a submariner. A submariner would say we should have both, right? But of course, you know, the military, as you know, always want everything, and the problem is their ambitions are way in excess of any government's budget. But let's accept naval nuclear propulsion is the way to go. We should, at the very least, have had a discussion with France about that, because we could have got it a lot cheaper and a lot sooner with France. There's no question.
But you never discussed that with Macron as a possibility, or did you?
Well, I did. I mean, I had. I mean, but it was always a potential possibility. But but Morrison did not. Now, that, you know, some people have suggested to me that was because of American distrust of France. I don't know. I mean, I've never understood the relationship between France and the US has both long-standing, close but complex. But you know, the French naval nuclear propulsion technology is in many respects superior to that used by the United States. And the reason is that France uses low-enriched uranium. A lot of people in your country actually have been arguing for years that America should do the same. The American reactors, which are the same ones the British use, use weapons-grade uranium, which is enriched up. You know, it's from the former, you know, it's uranium that was enriched for nuclear warheads, and it's enriched up to about 95%. That enables the reactors to be smaller, which I guess is why they originally did it, and they had plenty available. But, of course, you know, it is a stock that is presently diminishing, and also, you know, the proliferation risks are obvious. France uses the same, essentially the same uranium that in its submarines as it does in its civilian power plants, as does China, by the way. So China and France use LEU, low-enriched uranium. The UK, US, and Russia use highly enriched uranium. So, you know, there are arguments in favor of the French approach, and, you know, there are proliferation, you know, people, anti-proliferation people who would argue for that in that switch to be made in America. But, you know, I suspect
I just want to point out that my understanding is it was the Australians who approached the US with this.
Yes, they did. Program. Yeah, that's the history. It's a bit murky, but the history appears to be Morrison approached the UK, who then approached the US. But he, you know, as far as France was concerned, what he did was, I mean, the French deal, the French project was it was running like 18 months late because of the pandemic and COVID and so forth, but it was running within its budget. There was no budget blowout, and it was proceeding satisfactorily. And literally the week before AUKUS was announced, France had been advised that, you know, all was well and the project was proceeding. We were proceeding to the next stage of the contract. So there was, and Morrison has justified this, and others in the government have justified it by saying, well, we had to deceive the French because if we told them the truth, they would have had an open discussion with the Americans, and we may not have been able to pull it off. Now, you know, I find that just utterly reprehensible. You know what I mean? France, particularly, you know, we're talking about the Indo-Pacific. France is a major, as you guys know very well, France has got major territories in the Pacific. I mean, it's got it's all very well to talk about, you know, defence ties with the UK, and I've got nothing against that, but Britain has no direct interest to protect in the Pacific. France has, you know, large territories. It's got, between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, it's probably got, you know, 2.5 million citizens living on territories that are part of France. You know, it has permanent military, assets, you know, and people stationed here. So it's, you know, my big idea, which Morrison blew up, and I think, you know, frankly, the US could have responsibly prevented him doing so, discouraged him from doing so. My big idea was to bring France more closely into working in partnership with us and our allies, particularly the US, in this part of the world. And I can't see why that would be anything other than a very good idea. But that was, you know, and France's under Macron, France's, indeed the EU's Indo-Pacific strategy was all premised on that. So that was literally dynamited by the way AUKUS was inaugurated. It was, I thought it was very, very reckless and very regrettable. But AUKUS Pillar 2, you know, 10 out of 10, we just got to make sure it fulfills its promise. AUKUS Pillar 1, the subs, I think the most likely outcome, honestly, is that we will get no subs. I think the Congressional Research Service analysis is about right. I think we'll end up with nothing. There may be something emerging from the partnership with the UK, but man, that's a long way away. And, you know, it kind of begs the question, why would we cooperate with the UK to build a boat? Surely, if we're going to be so close and chummy, why wouldn't the US, UK and Australia just have one boat and share it? I mean, why wouldn't we just, you know, have whatever succeeds the Virginia be the SSN that is used by the three navies? That would make so much more sense. And you start to wonder whether, you know, was AUKUS Pillar One, the only unquestioned winner I can see out of that AUKUS Pillar One is the UK shipbuilding industry, literally the only one. I mean, I think AUKUS Pillar One creates real problems for the US, because you can, I mean, you guys know, you live in the US. I mean, you know better than me. I mean, Trump says America first, right? But that's not unique to Trump. I mean, that is the zeitgeist. Can you imagine a situation if the Navy is saying, Mr. President, we need more Virginias. We are short of Virginia. We are short of SSNs. They are the most survivable part of our fleet. Can you imagine an American president saying, well, I don't care what you say. I've decided we're going to transfer a couple to the Australians. What's the Congress going to say about that? I mean, you know, it's that great old political saying you would have heard in Australia, Jim, you know, in the great race of life, always back self-interest because you know it's trying. So,
well, I think Jim and I would both argue vigorously that it is in America's self-interest to make sure that we honor our commitments with our allies. But be that as it may,
yeah, but Ray, if I could just to, I know I've done most of the talking here, I'm apologize for that, but just to correct you there, though, it's not a question of honoring your commitment. The agreement expressly says that you only get the sub. So it's like you and me agreeing to you. I agree with you, Ray. You can drive my car on Sunday if I don't need it to, you know, take my grandkids to the zoo. And you ring me up on Sunday and you say, can I get your car? And I say, I'm sorry, Ray, I've got to take the grandkids to the zoo today. You say, okay, fair enough. So this is the point I'm making, is the US doesn't have to double cross us. It's literally in the legislation. So that's a risk. So effectively, we have taken that risk. We've taken that risk. And that's the problem I've got is that we have no ability on our own to mitigate it.
I do think, though, that, you know, and I understand what you're saying, but I do think there is a spirit of the law and the letter of the law. And the spirit of the law, or the spirit of the agreement in this case, really is that for the U.S. to leave Australia high and dry without its own submarine capability would be an abrogation of the spirit of the agreement. I do want to move on from that, because I want to give you a chance to talk about China a little bit, in part because your government was so concerned during that period of time with foreign interference, and then also with that very controversial and important decision around whether or not to allow Huawei into help build Australia's 5G network. I wonder if you could take us back to those decisions that you made at the time and those discussions that you led at the time. And how difficult was that for Australia to really be out front on the 5G discussion?
Well, okay. Well, they were sort of related, but separate. Just dealing with 5G, we were ahead of our allies on 5G. That's true. I'd raised it really from the beginning of the Trump administration. I can't recall whether I raised it with Obama. I'd have to check. But certainly from early 2017, I was raising it in Washington. And our concern was, and my concern in particular was, that 5G, you know, which is obviously the, you know, fifth generation of wireless, was a a collection of technologies that involved greater virtualization, so much more software dependent, much more of the, if you like, the intelligence, the processing, whether it's routing or, lawful interception, all of the processing and decision making, if you like, in the network was being taken throughout the network, including it on the edge of the network, what we would normally have just said was, just fairly dumb capabilities or functions, routing traffic into a central core. And I think, we're all old enough to have seen those onion diagrams that you would, the signals intelligence people would have. They'd say, well, here is the core in the center. We've got to make sure we protect that. And then we go out and out and out, and you get out to the edge and handheld devices and antennas. And, it doesn't sort of matter so much who makes them, whatever. But so 5G was very different. And my concern was that in an environment where the core was effectively no more, was there a way in which you could have a Chinese vendor, Huawei or ZTE, but notably Huawei, involved and mitigate the risk of interference, disruption, because you'd basically be having a absolutely critical platform in your economy literally only understood and by people in China. Now, you could say the same thing about Ericsson, I guess, but do we lie awake at night fretting about the malign intentions of the Kingdom of Sweden? No, we don't. We are relaxed about the Swedes. That may be complacency, who knows, but that's how we thought. So we did a huge amount of work and talked to our partners in the Five Eyes about how to mitigate the risk with 5G. And I went in particular back and forth with Mike Burgess, who was then the head of the Australian Signals Directorate, and we came to the view that technically we couldn't mitigate it. So it wasn't a political decision, and it absolutely was not requested or directed or encouraged by the US. And so that was the decision we came to, and then we put it in place. And, fortunately, we already had the legislation that enabled us to do it. So that was 5G. It was a risk-based decision based on technology, bluntly. And it was nothing personal. And, we said to the Chinese government at the time, we said, look, it's nothing personal. This is just risk management. We're not accusing you of anything. It's just, you wouldn't let us, run a wireless network in your country. And, there are things where we, the way, and I think this is an important thing. This really underlines my approach to China, which has always, I think, been pretty clear-eyed, is there are areas, you've got to have boundaries of trust. There are areas, and you think of your personal life, there are people with whom you have 100% trust, perhaps your wife or your husband. There are others, that you've got a high degree of trust, but not complete, maybe people in friends, people you know in business and so forth. Well, it's the same between nations. There are some things you only trust with your own nationals. There are others things you trust with very close allies. And there are other things where you've got countries where you have a more potentially rivalrous relationship where you will have a trusted relationship in area A, but not in area B or C. And, we all understand that. So that was 5G. As far as the foreign interference and foreign influence legislation, there was obviously a lot of, gigantic amount of Chinese espionage going on in Australia, as there is everywhere, particularly, in the cyberspace. Our espionage legislation was very out of date, bluntly. This happens with legislation. We needed to update that to deal with modern forms of foreign interference. And we also didn't have foreign influence legislation. We had no equivalent of your FARA legislation. And so we introduced both of those. And I mean, they were Chinese, you know, interference and influence activities were, I guess, the largest single motivator for that, but they weren't the only one by any means. So that was a bit of important housekeeping. But yeah, so we addressed both of those and got on with them. And, you know, that provoked outrage in Beijing. But, you know, again, we have to weather that.
So how do you think the current government is in Australia is handling the relationship with China?
Look, I think pretty well, Jim, to be honest with you. I think Morrison and his, you know, and Peter Dutton, who was the defence minister for much of Morrison's time, or Home Affairs Minister, who's now the opposition leader, for reasons of domestic political, you know, advantage or perceived advantage, used a lot of very bellicose language about China. And, you know, for example, you know, the call for a independent inquiry into the origins of the COVID virus. Now, you know, when I say that wasn't so much bellicose, and I'm not saying that I think that was a perfectly reasonable thing to ask for. But again, you know, me, former professional prime minister, I suppose, you professional diplomats, just because something is reasonable doesn't mean you should say it. And you've got to think about it. And Scott was very, very focused on, you know, and of course he was playing into that Murdoch sort of right-wing media, you know, ecosystem. And, you know, being tough on China was very, you know, played well there. And, I mean, you guys are very familiar with this in America. And he did a fair bit of that. I think China, the Communist Party, massively overreacted and overplayed their hand, both rhetorically and then with economic attempts at economic coercion and trade sanctions and so forth. And so my criticism of Morrison is limited to saying he didn't need to beat the drum as hard as he did, right? That's my point. I mean, and I give you the counterfactual. When I announced, when we did the 5G decision, we had a very, very carefully planned approach to that. It was flagged in advance to Beijing and indeed Washington and London and Tokyo in advance. Nobody was surprised. The announcement was made in a press release by the communications minister. It didn't have the prime minister's name or the foreign minister's name on it. We wanted to effect the change, but we didn't want to turn it into a rah-rah political, you know, I'm tough on China type thing. There was nothing to be gained for us in doing that. No, I think Scott was very focused on political advantage in Australia, and that in a sense played into Beijing's hands because they could then, you know, react. And of course, as they've often done in recent times, and this is where Xi Jinping's foreign policy has been so counterproductive, they overreacted and imposed these trade sanctions, which achieved nothing. I mean, they hurt a couple of our industries for sure, particularly wine. But they demonstrated the ineffectiveness of that type of economic coercion. And all it did was, you know, alienate people, lower trust in China. I mean, it was Xi Jinping's foreign policy has been quite counterproductive. And I know we've talked about that privately before. I've seen this film on quite a few occasions with Beijing. Once something doesn't work, they will not continue with it, but they have to find an elegant dismount. They need to find an exit ramp. To, you know, they can't just, they're not going to say, whoa, we screwed up, boys, we're changing course. And so they were waiting for a change of government or a change of prime minister. I think, frankly, if Morrison had gone, you know, and Josh Frydenberg, for example, had become Liberal prime minister, they would have done the same thing. They were just looking for an exit ramp. And so the Labor government came in. The substantive policy positions have not changed. They're exactly the same. But the, you know, the temperature has lowered, you know, the sort of, you know, drums of war type rhetoric have been quietened, which was sensible. And you've seen relations, you know, moving back to a more conventional one with the trade sanctions being rolled back and so forth. But, you know, we're not going to get back to the heady days of, you know, a decade ago. There's no question of that. The relationship has changed and become a much warier one. But I think it's healthier at this stage, I think. But the big mistakes, I mean, if you take that vaccine call, the call for the inquiry, that caused a conflagration in Beijing. When I say it caused, they chose to create a conflagration in response to it. If Beijing had ignored it, it would have sunk without trace. If they had said, oh, that's interesting, you know, if asked, oh, that's interesting, we see the Australian foreign minister or prime minister, whatever, has said that, that's interesting. Well, the World Health Administration will no doubt have a look at this in due course. And, you know, we're quite satisfied the, you know, cause of the virus, you know, was not from any lab or whatever. You know, I mean, they could have just batted it away, but they chose to make it into a mega issue. This is where, you know, you've got to always be looking at not just asking, am I saying something or doing something which is sensible and reasonable, but what are the, what are the consequences going to be? And I mean, again, getting back to, you know, this guy, Phil Gordon, you know, who's very close to Harris. You know, in this book of his, Losing the Long Game, about, you know, the failures of American sort of nation building and regime changing, really, in the Middle East over 70 years. It gets back to that fundamental, you know, so like that question, you know, was Saddam Hussein a bad guy, a terrible tyrant that, you know, would be, that, you know, deserved to be, you know, pushed over? Yeah, for sure. But who wins out of that? And if the ultimate winner is in fact Iran, that's been a massive blunder, massive, massive blunder. And I mean, this is where this is where it does pay to have good diplomats like you two and presidents that take their advice, because you've got to think these things, all of these things through, and not just look to the immediacy of the headline or the immediate impact.
Well, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, I have five more questions, but we have certainly taken far too much of your time already. It has indeed been a privilege and really a fascinating opportunity to get your really very unique perspective on a really important topic for us, which of course is our upcoming election, and really the insight for not just our American friends, but our international friends. So thank you, sir, for lending us so much of your time.
No worries. Thank you. Always lovely to chat.
Well, Malcolm, as always, isn't shy.
Well, you dealt with him a lot more directly than I did. And I remember hearing a lot of your stories about, you know, the way that he sort of would go directly at things. And that certainly bore out.
Well, you know, he made mention that the U.S. was behind the curve, which was true as far as doing something. But we were pressuring the Brits, I think, before they they were about not putting Huawei into their new 5G.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the thing I also remember about that discussion is that it really did. He talked himself about himself as being an enthusiastic amateur. And I think, you know, in terms of the technology behind 5G, you know, very few people at that level are going to dive in and try to understand the ins and outs of something as complicated as 5G.
Well, he was, you know, he made a lot of his money from being one of the first ISPs in Australia. And then he was Minister of Communications. So he's got a background.
Yeah.
Interesting, of course, were his insights into Donald Trump and dealing with Trump and how to deal with him. But it's concerning that even with his relative success dealing with Trump, he is more concerned this time.
Yeah, I do remember the thing that I remember about our time there in dealing with the erratic nature of communications coming out of not Washington, D.C. per se, but you know, the White House, is that, of course, they happened by these completely unconventional and non-traditional, you know, means. Of course, the famous 2 a.m. tweets and such. And I remember that the policy at the embassy, where you were in charge, was we will comment on policy. We will not comment on tweets or sort of sporadic utterances. And I specifically remember there was one issue where the question was F-35 manufacturing. And the President Trump had said something to the effect of, we need to pull it all back to the United States. And of course, the Aussies had some of that they were doing. And it was an international, it was designed as an international effort, even though most of it happened in the US. And of course, the Aussies were very concerned. And as I went over to the Russell Building, which is their Pentagon, and they were sort of on me to, what did the president mean by that? And I remember saying, just wait 48 hours. If nothing else happens, it's a ship that passed in the night. It doesn't mean anything. Just don't remind him about it. And that turned out to be the case. It was just a ship that passed in the night. And that was something that was unfamiliar to anybody in dealing with presidential communications, because no president had ever communicated that way before.
But we all learned.
We did. We had to, and we did okay. I think we muddled through it. And there were some positives. You know, again, the new national security strategy, national defense strategy, that came out of those early years was really important work. And so it wasn't all just tweets and chaos. There were some actual good things that were accomplished during that time.
Okay.
All right. Well, Jim, that was a long one. So we'll go ahead and get out of here on that. And again, once again, thanks again to our producer, Ian Ellis Jones. You can follow us on X or on LinkedIn. I want to remind you that you can always find us on social media. And we look forward to talking to you next time on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.